You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
Hey, this is Brian Callen, Brian Callen Show, and I'm sitting here with, in my opinion, the best voice in sports announcing, Mr. Bruce Buffer in the house, who I've known for 15 years.
I think 15 years around the MMA and the entertainment and sports community.
That's exactly right. And I was saying, I said to you one time, because I've always been amazed at how just unbelievable you are at these high pressure situations, and you create such theater beforehand, like, it's time, and standing to my right, he weighs 170, but as a performer, I watch you do that in front of all those people. You never miss a beat. You never miss a word. You never miss it. It's just so, it's rhythmically so perfect. And I remember I asked you, I go, do you rehearse that? And you were like, nope.
No. You know, it's, you do film, and you know the rehearsals that goes into doing a film, which can be one of the most boring long days on the set ever.
Of all time.
Of all time. Yeah. You do your stand-up, which I know you don't rehearse. You might get pumped up, but I know you walk out there and just get it going. That's kind of the way I am when I walk out into a show, because I don't like rehearsing, because that'll give me two images of myself.
Right.
The rehearsal voice.
Right.
The real live voice.
Right.
So I want to feel it all. I do this whole thing based on the passion I have for the sport, which just gets more and more each year. So when I walk out into the arena on any given night, whether it's Tokyo, Canada, Brazil, which is an amazing experience in Brazil, when they yell back, it's time, as I'm saying it, the entire stadium, not just a few guys, the entire stadium.
It's time! Yeah.
And these are Portuguese-speaking individuals.
Oh, man.
Maximum confidence, but I feed off that energy, it's like the roar of the grease paint, the smell of the crowd, you know, it's like the roar of the crowd.
Yeah.
It's like, it just gets me going, and I feel like it's my first show ever, and I just want to enjoy that experience, because if I don't have fun at what I do, it's time for me to step down and retire.
But you are a huge part of the UFC. It was funny. Last weigh-in I was at, I was just watching all these people want to take pictures with you and stuff like that. You know, and it's funny how, like, sort of the nature of celebrity and what can happen, you know, because people start to equate you with an experience, and usually a heightened experience. So you're a huge part of that. You know, I actually personally can't imagine the UFC without your voice.
Thank you.
But the other thing that I want to talk about is your half brother, Michael, who I've worked with as well on Mad TV. Michael, for a long time, was the most famous voice in sports announcing.
He's absolutely.
Let's get ready to rumble.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting to me that you didn't know your half-brother until later on in your life. Is that correct?
No, I didn't. But you owe me $5 licensing fee for that five words you just said. So you can pay
You
can pay me on the way out.
I will do so.
That's how we make our living
But
here.
What's funny is that you went into announcing as well. And now in some ways, you know, you've become, you know, arguably the most recognized voice in the whole, in the arena. So that's a weird coincidence, or
it's actually a weird coincidence. But the whole way that we met is a weird coincidence, because I go into this deeply. Random House is releasing my book here in the United States on May 14th, and
is it coming out on Audible? Because I'm sponsored by Audible.
You mean the audio
Your
version?
Book, yeah,
I will be an audio version. I hope to within a year, but at first it'll be Kindle and it'll be the hardback. And
because I have I recommend books on my website, so a lot of people go.
Do they have to be audio?
No. No, not at all.
Okay, I'll get your copy.
Okay.
So, yeah, I would love for you to do that.
We'll put it on the website.
No, I appreciate that.
All right, good.
And the reviews so far have been that it's been a cracker of a book, but it's not your typical, and I don't want to get too far into the book, but it's not your typical, oh, I'm here in UFC 140 and this person's standing there and that person's standing there. You can read about that on the internet and SureDog.com all day long. Okay.
Sure.
This is a behind-the-scenes thing, and it's the story of my life, and it's a big thing is how we met, because I was 31 years old when I met Michael. I did not realize that I had another brother out there.
Wow.
And what happened is that in 87, when Tyson got really popular, Michael was just in like the sixth year of his career. And he started to take off, and he started late, actually at the same age I started, around 37, 38. And what happened is that organically he got really huge because of Mike Tyson and all the attention paid to boxing in his heyday. And I saw this pretty boy, and I mean pretty boy.
He's a handsome guy.
He's a handsome guy.
He's a tall, handsome dude.
Yeah, total model. Like, why didn't I get
And with a fantastic voice.
Fantastic voice and all that poise and all that he puts into it. He's just a legendary icon.
Perfect hair.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Some things do go genetically. But in this respect, like, I'm, you know, people say I'm handsome with scars. This guy's pretty. So now I'm looking at this pretty boy, and it's like, his last name is Buffer. Now, I was in telemarketing for years, and it's a natural thing. You look in every phone book of every city, and I never saw my last name anywhere. And I go, what the hell is going on here? Mm. Long story cut short, people were coming up to me, is that your brother? Is that your brother? Finally, a year later, after doing some research, finding out he grew up like 20 miles away from where I grew up in Philadelphia, things were just too close. And he looks very much like my grandfather and my dad. My grandfather was the 1921 bantamweight flyweight boxing champion of the world.
Wow.
Bert Sugar called him the greatest fighter of 1921. He's in the history books, guys. His name is Johnny Buff. Okay.
Wow.
So fighting's been in my blood. It's genetic with me. So then he makes his way into the world of boxing, and I'm telling my dad this, and my dad's driving with me up to San Francisco, and he just casually looks at me, and he says, I think that's your brother. What the F are you talking about, right?
Oh, by the way.
By the way, I didn't tell you I was married briefly during World War II, and I was young, and I came back from being overseas in the Pacific for 9 months, and a son was born, and a divorce ensued, and here's the kicker. Michael was raised by foster parents, right? Mm-hmm. And he was raised under the name of Huber. So then when he went in the Army, they said, no, your birth certificate says Buffer because you're never formally adopted.
Wow.
So your name's Buffer. Had that not happened, you and I would not be sitting here having this interview right now because I would not have searched him out. I would have not found out he's my brother. I would have not quit two businesses I had making a crap load of money in 92, really sitting pretty. But I wasn't passionate about what I was doing. So very simply, I went to him after watching the Riddick Bo Holyfield fight in 1992, November 13th. I'll never forget it. Okay. And I went back to my room, and what are we doing when we go to Vegas? We want to gamble. We want to meet girls.
Sure.
We want to have fun, you know.
Right.
We want to get it on, right?
Yeah.
So I just wanted to go back to my room, and I took out my legal pad. And I wrote pages and pages of notes of how I want to trademark this phrase properly, and I want to put him in every field of sports and entertainment that's popular and hot, because the Rumble is not about fighting. It's about the clarion call to the pure integrity of the competitive spirit. And that's the way I envisioned it. But nobody had ever taken him under their arm. Nobody ever made a hat or a T-shirt with that phrase. And he was just the boxing guy. It was time to make a richer, more famous than he ever dreamed. And I told him that, and he said, how are you going to do it? And I said, well, first thing I'm going to do is sell my two companies, so my focus is on you. I'm going to quit with the money I have in the bank, and I'll figure it out. Just trust me.
Wow.
And to date, we've sold over $400 million in retail sales of products I've created with the brand, and not alone all the Mad TVs and everything he's done since then. And it's just been an amazing
ride. So you guys kind of have a company, a joint company then?
We have a partnership where I handle all the management of the phrase that he owns, the famous phrase. I've trademarked it in a variety of different ways.
Wow.
So if we make a movie like Ready to Rumble with Warner Brothers, or if somebody wants to put it on a TV show like Friends or something like that, well, then they have to license it through me. If a football team, which we have many over the years that have played it at the kickoff, let's get ready to, you know, and also
kick off.
They started doing that. See these gold and platinum records?
Yeah.
This is an album called Jock Jams that I had the first cut is Michael's 25-second rendition of Let's Get Ready to Rumble. Now, here's how I prevented it from becoming an Andy Warhol 15 minutes of Where's the Beef? It's okay?
Yeah.
Of Where's the Beef or whatever, because on this went platinum and gold. They sold 2-3 million albums, right?
Wow.
On it is every major sports team from NBA to football to baseball to hockey would take this thing and play one of the cuts to jack up the audience inside the arena. Well, the first cut was Let's Get Ready to Rumble. So suddenly I'm watching TV and I'm hearing Let's Get Ready to Rumble everywhere. And it's like, they can't do that.
Right.
And I'm not an attorney, but at that time I didn't have an attorney like I have today or a force of attorneys. So I would literally call up the individual teams. I would get settlements out of them and I make them license it for the season to play it.
Fantastic, man.
And that way, I made it cheap for him too, because that way I knew everybody would hear it. And then when I went out to market and create a toy or a video game,
yeah,
I had this emphasis behind me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like a great movie you're in, that suddenly your career is hotter than ever because you're in Hangover,
right,
you know?
Right.
And then you get, boom, it gives you a lift, which I'm sure it did at that time, even with your glorious career being what it is.
Yeah.
We, in sports entertainment, you got to act on that stuff.
Yeah.
So I acted on it, and here's the kicker. If all the other songs are BMI ASCAP, so they wanted me to register with BMI and ASCAP. But that would have meant that every DJ, every sports team in the country would have been able to play it because they pay a fee of like $800 or $1,500 to BMI ASCAP so they can play those songs, right? Mm-mm. I didn't allow it. In my own little mind back then, not knowing anywhere near what I know today, I knew that would be a big mistake. So it forced them, every time somebody took it off the album, it would force them to have to answer to me to pay for the usage, to license it, if I thought it was a right fit. right? Mm-hmm. And that's what really helped the phrase really take off at that point from the standpoint of a licensing program and an actual business that really worked for us.
Well, and the other thing is, I don't think Bruce, I mean, Mike is a fighter, but you, I look around, you've got, you know, you're, you know, your weapons, you've been fighting, you know, Taekwondo, you've got, you know, I mean, I'm sure you've done some grappling as well.
Actually, my big thing in my age was wanting to be Chuck Norris and Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
So I
remember that.
Yeah. It was all
my
about
age too, brother.
It was all about the stand up, the striking. And
before MMA came along and stuff, we thought that guys like Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris were legit fighters, even though they may have been to an extent. But the truth is, if you put those guys into the octagon today with guys who can kick and punch the way they do and wrestle the way they do, they're going to have some problems.
I mean, well, they're not just going to have problems. I mean, unless they've taken the time like Chuck did, I know for a fact.
Yeah, even Bruce, he's got his black belt, right?
Yeah, and he trained. And I think he's still, even today, even with the work he's had done, because I heard, you know, his from Tang Soo-do, which is what I have a black belt in, which is the Korean style that he trained in when he was in the Air Force. And that's where he started his martial arts. But I think he's had to have a hip replaced, you know, because the brutal snapping.
He's older now, man.
He's older now.
He did a lot of his own stunts. I mean, that guy was active for years.
Chuck's great. He's one of the coolest guys you'll ever meet. He's so non. He's like, reminds me of Steve McQueen when I knew Steve McQueen. Mm. It's like these are non-Hollywood cool dudes.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, he's Chuck Norris. Come on.
He's Chuck Norris. What can you say about
Chuck
Norris?
That's all you got to say. He's Chuck Norris.
But my big thing was kickboxing. So I wanted to get out of the dojos, and just because of knowing what getting hit for real is like, if I was going to compete or even just train and want to stay in shape, I wanted to go against somebody that was either going to knock me out or me knock him out, even if it's just a good old-fashioned heavy sparring session, mm-hmm. which is...
Mm-hmm. That's how you learn how to fight,
That's how you learn how to fight.
You know.
So... At 32, I suffered my second concussion, and the doctor ordered me to stop heavy sparring. But I still train to this day, and I can do splits. I maintain my flexibility, and that's one of the pleasures of having trained in martial arts.
You just said that. I can do the splits. You should have just left it at that. And and podcast over. I can do the splits. Any more question? No, Bruce Buffer, not at all. Not anymore. In fact, he's been in the splits the whole time he's been talking.
And not just the splits, but one foot is on one chair and the other foot's on another
chair. Damn right. Yeah. You kidding me? It's the only way to do the splits.
I didn't know there was any other guy. John Club Van Dam, eat your heart out. Yeah.
Exactly. He lives around here, I think.
He lives over there. I've been over his house. He had me come over and meet him, talking about a movie potential one time.
I was going to say, he's had a little resurgence, a little rebirth.
Well, if you look at Jean-Claude and The Expendables, and I was really happy to see this, and I'll tell you why, because when I met, and I write about this in my book, and with all respect to Jean-Claude, I was first in line to see Jean-Claude movies.
Right.
Okay, you can say what you want about Steven Seagal. I was first in line during the Above the Law days to see Steven Seagal. And Chuck. Yeah. All those films, right?
Yeah.
So when Jean-Claude invited me over, it was kind of cool because I remember I partied with him at Bar One like 16 years ago in his heyday, and he was making mussels for the girls, and it was the mussels from Brussels.
Awesome.
It was awesome. A great night. We're playing
with those tight jeans.
Oh, the tight
all
jeans,
the way up
everything.
To his belly button. There it is.
Yeah, he had it all going for him. But when I got over his house, and he it's public knowledge, he admits he suffered from the cocaine abuse,
right.
Had bouts with depression, has had a rough go. Let's face it, this was a glory boy, but this is a tough business.
Yep.
And when you fall to the right and off the precipice a little bit, they eat you up.
Yep.
So I looked at him and I thought, wow, Jean-Claude, you've aged. I think in my head, you've aged a little bit. So we're talking and he's talking and he says to me, well, you know, when you're my age, and I said, Jean-Claude, how old are you? Because I'm 44. I said, Jean-Claude, I'm 48. Right? And I think,
oh boy.
Yeah. Oh
boy, drugs do age you, man.
They
you see
hurt.
It.
Now, did you ever see JCVD,
no,
his movie?
No.
You must rent, everybody out there, if you like Jean-Claude, you must rent the movie JCVD. It's a story where he's in Belgium, and he's basically playing himself. So he goes back to his hometown, and he goes to the bank. While he's in the bank to make a transaction, the bank's robbed, and he's taken hostage. Now, here's your famous movie hero who's whipped everybody's ass.
Is this
ass.
True, or this is just
this is
movie?
The movie, okay. But it's kind of like it's based on his life.
Right.
So, but he's not Jean-Claude. He's a character in the film.
Wow.
Actually... You know, it's called JCVD, so
I
may be
Jean-Claude
wrong.
I love Jean-Claude Van Damme, JCVD.
He may be playing himself in a fictional instance.
Right.
But what happened is that he's locked in the back with the hostages, and you're wondering, when is he going to light this place up? But he has this five-minute or so soliloquy with the camera, with the tears in his eyes, and talking about how he came to the height of his career, and he ruined his career with his drug abuse and this and that. It's one of the most honest, Oscar-worthy, this sounds crazy with Jean-Claude Van Damme in the same sentence, Oscar-worthy performances that any actor in acting school should try and do this for their class. It's either that or the scene with Dennis Hopper and Christopher Walken from
True Romance.
True Romance.
One of the best scenes ever, by the way.
These are acting class scenes to impress your teacher.
Yeah.
Okay? Get this film and see it.
JCVD.
JCVD.
I'm all over it.
And then now I see him in The Expendables, and I saw him recently at the gym, and he's still built like a brick.
Yeah.
Right?
He's a natural mesomorph.
He's a natural. And he's just a really cool guy. Yeah. He's a nice guy. He's trying to resurrect Bloodsport, by the way.
I think drugs and I think this business, after you've been in it long enough, and when you crash like that, it humbles you. You either die or you come out humbled. I mean, you know.
Well, there's a segue to that a little bit, or a parable to that. Because I believe that, and I walk with a swagger. I walk with a lot of confidence. Mm-hmm. But I'm not arrogant. Mm-hmm. And I'm not cocky. And if I'm perceived as such at times, it actually would hurt me because I pride myself in the fact that I'm not. I hate arrogance. I hate cockiness.
Well, I've seen how gracious you are to fans, like people who want to take pictures and stuff like that.
That's what pays our paycheck. Without the fans, we're nothing. Exactly. They deserve every.
But I know you appreciate it. Like, you appreciate what you do and where you are, you know?
Absolutely. I kiss the ground every day I wake up. I'm not religious. I'm spiritual, but I'll say thank God, because wherever your God is, I'm thanking him right now.
Yeah.
I wake up in love every day I live.
Still in the splits, by the way, when he's talking about religion.
Yeah, I know, but I moved and I'm on coffee cans now.
I didn't even see you do that, dude.
That's how slick I am.
You are a fucking airbender.
But when I see somebody that reaches a certain level, and I can name a few fighters that have gotten there, not too many, but a few, and they get that cockiness or that arrogance, well, dude, you're going down.
Right.
Okay? Actor, actress, whatever, the moment you think that you're better than somebody else, yeah, except for the art that you do, because mm-hmm. you want to be the best, mm-hmm. like, you're just an incredible comedian. I've told you before how I love your physicality. You're amazing.
Thanks,
you're so
buddy.
Different than so many I get to see.
Can't
and I'm,
do the
I'm
splits,
a
but I do have physicality.
That's okay. I'll teach you after this.
Thank you. Thank you.
You might scream out a bit.
It's your splits workshop.
We're going to go to Joe Rogan and have a split contest.
It sounds very homoerotic. you got to take my splits workout. My splits workshop.
On DVD, on an infomercial near you soon.
Exactly.
So it's like, won't you agree that the moment you see that, I think they're hurting their careers more than helping them?
Well, I was talking to Brendan Schaub recently about just the kind of pressure that somebody deals with in the UFC nowadays, you know, because if you don't win enough fights, you get cut, you know, and you're also fighting killers. And one of the things about the UFC and one of the things I love about fighters, especially in the UFC, is it's almost impossible to if you are cocky, it's almost impossible to stay cocky because everybody you know, Alistair Overeem, I don't care who it is, everybody you know, with the exception of the Spider and the exception of George St. Pierre, but even them, everybody you know has been knocked out or tapped out. And, you know, when another man imposes his will on you like that, it is very humbling, and you become acutely aware of your own mortality.
Oh, there's no question. And one experience I had like that, and I'm giving away something else from the book, but that's your show, right? So I'll do it. 1991... A director named John Milius. Do you know who John Milius is?
The name, yeah.
He wrote Apocalypse Now.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
he directed Red Dawn,
sure.
Conan the Barbarian. He used to come over to my house, you know, for Sunday brunch. He loved my mom's cooking all the time. So he knew I was heavily kickboxing. I was training five times a week. I was heavy sparring every Saturday for 2 hours. You know, it's on and on and on. I loved every second of it. And he said, you know, I know you're doing this, and I know you got the Tang-Sudo background and judo background that you have and all that. He said, but you need to come over with me. I'm training this jiu-jitsu. I go, I've trained some jiu-jitsu, John. He goes, no, you haven't trained Gracie jiu-jitsu. Okay, the submission stuff that they do is amazing.
Mm.
I said, fine, I'll meet you. Let's go over. So he takes me over to Torrance. This is 1991. Remember, the UFC didn't come out till 1993.
Is that Machado's, Jean-Jacques' place?
No, this was Hoyce's place.
Okay.
So he Horian and Hoyce.
Right.
So he takes me over there. I didn't know who Horian is. I certainly didn't know who Hoyce was. I walk in, respectful as you should always be when you walk into any dojo, and the skinny kid comes out, inch taller than me, Hoyce. And he goes, hi, how are you? I go, hi, how are you? Non-menacing looking, you know, 175 pounds, you know.
Sure.
I certainly respect the belt on his, you know, waist and know that he knows his stuff. But I didn't know exactly what he knew, right?
Yeah.
So he invites me.
You can smell it. You walk into a dojo.
You smell it.
And you see that worn black belt.
Yeah.
And you see someone's hands and you shake their hands. You look at their ears. You're like, something's going on here.
Something's going on here. It's like in high school.
It's like Koscheck one time when I shook his hand and kind of like, I kind of touched his shoulder and I was like, oh, you're just a different kind of human being. You've been fighting your whole life in one way or another.
Well, they're like human pit bulls.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Touch the back of Danny Henderson. It's like touching a Brahm bull.
Well, I hear that Dan Henderson's the strongest. I've heard people say there's wrestling strong and then there's Dan Henderson.
I agree with that.
Chimp,
you know? I absolutely agree with that. But I will tell you that, you know, my younger days when the shit was about to hit the fan, if I knew a guy was a wrestler,
yeah,
I thought twice.
Oh, yeah, you're damn right.
Absolutely thought twice. No question. I don't want to mess with a wrestler.
I was a wrestler, so I know
you
that.
Understand. Yeah,
I just know it intimately.
One hand, then all of a sudden I got, you know, hello. I did wrestle when I was in Pennsylvania as a kid at 14, and I hold the record for the fastest pin ever in the state of Pennsylvania.
Really?
Yeah, I got pinned in 13 seconds by a state champion or something like that. The guy picked me up and pinned me.
I
hold the record for being pinned the fastest in my age group
that
back then.
That is awesome. You hear it first here on the Brian Callen Show. But continue with the because the Gracies had an answer to wrestling.
Well, yeah. So what happened is Hoist takes me into one of his private rooms. It closes the door. It's all padded up. I'll never forget it. And he says, "Well, I hear you're kickboxing. You're a good kickboxer." He goes, "Let's spar. You come at me. You want to put on a pair of gloves?" He goes, No. Come at me." I go, "Bare fist?" He goes, "Yeah, with all you got, come at me." That the way they talk.
No problem. My friend, just come at me. To try to clinch me.
So I go at him, and maybe it was 30 seconds, maybe it was 20 seconds. I don't know.
I know.
Got underneath my punches, took me down, got me in a side choke. He's choking me out. I'm starting to go out.
Yeah.
And he goes, "Tap, tap, tap." So I tap, and I remember he leaned up on me in the mount, and he adjusted his gi, and he goes, "See? Isn't it nice not to get hit in the face?" I'll never forget that long as I live.
That's great.
He literally threw 20 years of training out the friggin' door, right with that one
move.
That's
it. Well, that's the thing. It's hard to be cocky when there are men out there that can do that to you that quickly. I mean,
it blew me away.
And that's the thing about the UFC today. It's evolving so quickly that if you don't have a very smart camp, and more importantly, if you're not always evolving yourself, you're going to lose your next fight. I mean, the pressure on these guys, it seems to me, to continue to get better and be up on new technology. It's like almost an arms race, man. I mean, wouldn't you agree with that?
Well, I agree it's an arms race, and it's not just keeping up with the Joneses. It's keeping ahead of the Joneses.
Yeah.
It's like as soon as they come out with another bullet, it's like, how do I make this Kevlar vest stronger to stop this bullet and survive this shot?
And also your game plan, you know? Like even your game plan where you know, I was thinking about Nate, who's my dear friend, Nate Marquardt, and fighting Safradine. Whatever happened, they didn't game plan probably enough for those damn leg kicks. And, as great a fighter as Nate is, and he's a great fighter, anybody, if you're not game plan for something that somebody shows up with, man, it can really create a problem.
Well, there's those fighters that are very cerebral fighters like a Randy Couture, you know, who probably could even call the round he was going to beat you in.
Wow.
Even though it's just, I think Randy's game plan was, he's probably one of the best of the best at that. And it actually amazed me after he fought Brock Lesnar, because he told me, we were at Mike Goldberg's celebration of his 100th UFC, birthday party combination type thing. And Randy was there, and this was the day after the fight. And I said, "Randy, what do you think?" He goes, "You know, every time he threw a punch at me, it's like the arm just kept coming. If I dodged it and he hit me with the inside, it hurt. If he hit me with the elbow, it's like I didn't realize how long he had a 10-inch reach on
me." Very long arms.
But I thought to myself, and I said, "Randy, you're the best game planner there is. How could you miss that one little subject? Not that it would have made a difference, but how could you miss that one little subject?" It just happens.
Well, the way it happens, though, is it's really hard to get a sparring partner who's as athletic and as long and as strong as Brock Lesnar. I mean, sometimes when you're fighting a physical freak like that, it's really hard to, you know, Randy probably walks at 220.
Easily 220, 225.
Okay, but he's fighting a guy who's 265, 270, 280.
I mean,
you know, he's walking around. So it's a very different kind of animal.
It's a different kind of thing.
I mean,
and
maybe even bigger than that. I think Lesnar probably might walk at 300.
No,
sometimes.
I would say Lesnar definitely walks around at 300.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's a silverback. Blonde silverback.
Absolutely, without question. He's probably one of the few heavyweights that actually has to cut weight.
Here's what I wanted to ask you. You've been in such close proximity to some of these incredible fights. And I wondered what it does to you psychologically to see that kind of violence up close all the time. Do you think it's changed you a little bit? Has it made you, because have you numbed to it? And more importantly, then I want to ask you, because you've had such a cage side, such an incredible bird's eye view to this, what your favorite fights have been of all time?
Well, I'll preface it by saying I forgot more than I can remember because I've announced thousands of fights
thousands,
in and out of the
thousands, man.
Just figure that I've announced at least in the area of 200 or more UFCs.
Yeah.
So just take 10 fights at UFC, that's 2,000 fights. That's
amazing.
Not counting the King of the Cages, the K-1s, and all the other events I did before I went exclusive, because I was announcing whether it's ADD Submission Wrestling Championships or tournaments for the Sheikhs of Kuwait that Big John McCarthy and I went over.
I've had all over.
Oh, yeah. Randy and I even went to Australia once and did like the first MMA event there. I went to England, did the second MMA event there. I used to try to pride myself on being a pioneer to go to these different countries when invited so I could help. My whole thing in the UFC from the beginning was to let MMA, what became MMA, originally it was just UFC, was to expand the mixed martial arts and do what I could to help grow the sport. I'm just not in there announcing.
I don't even think you need to. I think just being as active a participant as you've been, it's become its own phenomenon. Man.
It's a phenomenon. But yeah. In answer to your question, I've been exposed to fighting through my father at a young age. He was a Marine drill instructor. He was teaching me techniques and street fighting techniques when I was literally 5 or 6 going to school in Philadelphia. Mm. He taught me how to foot stomp. He said, if a kid grabs from behind, you pick it up and you practically, you plant your foot as hard as you can in his instep, he will let you go.
Right.
Do you know the first time I got attacked in school? I went to a school, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but I went to an interracial school in Philly. Had to fight for the lunch money.
Philly's a tough town, dude.
It's a tough town.
Philly, are you Italian? Is that?
Yeah, I'm Italian. So,
yeah.
And I actually, when I was 14, the Italian gang group at my school actually used to mistake me for being Jewish because I had some Jewish friends, and they were beating up all the Jewish kids, and they were coming after me.
Philly's
and,
not the most tolerant place in the world.
No.
I've spent enough time in Philly, and you can talk to athletes who will tell you that the worst place to perform is in Philly because if you're on the opposing team, they will hate on you. Michael Irvin told me that when he hurt his neck, and he was playing for Dallas, and they were carrying him off the field. They booed him.
Big time.
I mean, that's Philly.
No, they're it's yeah. Once a Philadelphia Eagle fan, always a Philadelphia Eagle fan. And I'm still a Philadelphia Eagle fan, although I hate it when they got Michael Vick because I'm a dog lover. I'm an animal lover. Sorry, Michael.
You don't forgive him.
Quite honestly, I don't. Yeah. It's kind of a hard one for me to forgive. It's like, how do you forgive a pedophile? Yeah. You know, I'm sorry, I can't.
That's acceptable. I think he's had to deal with that for sure. He paid a price for it, didn't he?
Yeah, he paid a price.
$150 million and a couple years in jail.
Yeah. I mean, and then he served a sentence. He's doing work for the ASPCA, and we're segueing here a little bit, but
yeah.
I hope he continues that. And
this is what this whole play. It's no problem to segue. This is what the Brian Callen Show is about, man. We're just having a conversation.
But for the ADD personalities out there, I'm going to get back to the original question. So with that, I've seen the very dark end of the street. I've seen the dojos growing up. I've seen a lot of sport fighting even before I became the announcer for the UFC, and because I was big into boxing. So fighting was not new to me. And when I went to see
I just want to say to the people that your wall is a boxing. It looks like a mini boxing museum. I mean, you are so clearly a boxing fan.
I am.
Like, you're so clearly a fight fan. It's interesting to see. I'm looking around at your stuff and a sports fan in general.
Yeah, yeah. In general, a sports fan. My favorite sport, honestly, is surfing. It's something I've done since I was 15.
Oh, really?
It's
probably, you live on the beach, brother. So
well, I haven't left. I can't leave it. I got to smell the ocean, man.
That's amazing.
But that's my favorite sport, fighting being my second favorite sport. There's a lot of spirituality that comes with surfing that I share, so that's a whole other subject. But in the fighting world, it's like when I went to my first UFC, I got Michael the job with the UFC because I called and sold him on using Michael, signed him for 6-7 and Ultimate, and we went to Casper, Wyoming.
Michael Buffer, you're talking about?
Michael Buffer,
brother,
the great Michael Buffer, I have to say that. And then, not have to say that, I wish to say
we're
that.
We're talking about Michael Vick. You didn't get Michael Vick.
No.
Michael Buffer, yeah, go on.
And I love those defensive linemen that put a big X on his back and his head. You can imagine that? He's a wanted man. So if you're the dog-loving defensive end is going to take him apart every chance he gets.
That's exactly right.
So with that being said, when we went to Casper, Wyoming, and this was the first event that Tank Abbott came out at. Now, in those days, when we were sitting at the press conference and they were all up on the dais, and there's Tank Abbott, and Michael looked at me and I looked at him, and we go, that guy's one of the scariest mofos I think we've ever seen.
He's terrifying.
Terrifying.
Because Tank, you know, from what I understood, would drink enough vodka to black out and then just start swinging. You know, I mean, apparently there was Tank and then there was David. When he was David, he was intelligent and great and sweet. And when he was Tank, he was a scary guy, man.
A scary guy. He would not hesitate to take a guy to see who can knock each other out first. Take his $100 bill. The guy goes, "What are you going to do with the money?" Tank told me the story. So he puts the money in the guy's breast pocket. He goes, "I'll just pull it out when we're done." You know?
Wow.
But you've got to remember, he was the one-shot king. Tank Abbott today is not going to be as menacing as he was back then. I'm talking today if he was then today.
Yeah.
The guy, he'd get beat all the time.
Sure. He was a bar fighter.
A very tough,
athletic guy.
But this is another example. When you're asking about the fighting scene, is when we first went there, now Michael's jaw was on the floor watching those guys fight.
Yeah.
Mine was just enjoying it because I really had an appreciation for the different styles already.
But when you, for most men, it's really interesting, when they first see, when they're first introduced to an MMA fight, it's shocking. It's very hard for a lot of guys to deal with.
Oh, especially if all they've seen is boxing.
It's because it's so violent and it's a real fight. And a lot of guys get really, really, really messed up over it. And then what happens is they get addicted to it. Like first reaction is, Jesus, I can't even watch this. Once you're able to kind of get through that, and a lot of guys do, we just do, you're hooked. You're looking at something very different.
You know that I got a statistic when I was doing this thing for Fox last week. 74.5% of American males from 18 to 42, or 34, are fans of the UFC.
Wow.
What a staggering comment that
is.
Wow. Staggering.
It's because it's so honest. It's like Joe Rogan said, it's as close as you can get to watching two men kill each other with their bare hands, but it's more than that. It's also now highly trained athletes trying to do it and true martial artists. I mean, you have to know so much now just to compete, you know?
You have to be a scientist of fighting.
Yeah.
You have to be a chess player to think three steps ahead to survive.
It's a mental game.
It's a mental game. In boxing, which is apples and oranges, comparing sports, I do not compare the two, but in boxing, it's two weapons, Marcus of Queensbury rules, okay? Yeah. Over 40 weapons, give or take, in mixed martial arts. If the champion of the octagon faces the champion of the boxing ring, in the octagon, the boxer loses 99.99999% of the... If the champion of the octagon goes in the champion of boxing's squared ring world under Marcus of Queensbury rules, the UFC fighter loses.
Bernard Hopkins just won, I believe, his
48 years old.
He's 48 years old, just won a world title against a 31-year-old legit contender. I mean, a really good fighter. Bernard Hopkins, you have to put him in the top three greatest boxers of all time for that reason. I think he's a true legend and incredible. He's never really been hurt and finishes dudes. I mean, he took Kelly Pavlik, and you know, Kelly Pavlik was a great fighter. It goes on and on.
He finished Oscar De La Hoya with a liver shot.
It's crazy. Yeah. And Bernard Hopkins is an example of a guy who, even if you probably put the spider in with him just boxing, Bernard's going to fucking do whatever
he's
going to
toy with spider.
Yeah.
Spider could be a little harder to hit than most. There's only a handful of guys in MMA that I would even think could survive a 3-round boxing fight.
What in the world makes that guy, Anderson Silva, so unbelievable? How is he this good? You're close up. Well, is he just faster than we can imagine? Is he? I know they say, well, he's really fast, he's really accurate, but this guy sees what people are doing. It's like they're beginners.
He has Spidey sense. He's like the Spider-Man sense. You know, where the punch is coming from behind, he sees it coming. But the thing with Anderson Silva now is that his conditioning, his heart rate level poise of being in the octagon, he's so calm, as John Jones is, as many of the great fighters when you look at him. But his experience of being the master now, the older fighter, which he can be considered, it's almost about, like, to me, it's like learning how to fight. As a boxer, you want to throw punches, but you want to keep the distance you're throwing those punches with short. And you see in MMA the big loopers and the big the trick is to take as much distance with as much power and as much speed as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Sort of like a
economy of motion. Like
economy of motion, shall we say. And when you watch Anderson Silva, I think the experience and everything he's been through, his ability to read the way his opponents are going to move and to do something that I don't recommend for any fighter or person defending themselves in life, to keep his hands down and avoid punches, which is a Roy Jones prime style move. It's incredible.
I mean, when I saw what he did with Stephen Bonner, who's a killer, I mean, I just was like, you're doing what every guy fantasizes about doing. It's like people are fighting in slow motion for you.
Exactly, but that's the way he sees it.
It's so nuts.
It's
and he's a guy who's truly improved too. I mean, from when he started, I mean, this is a guy who has just improved so exponentially as a striker.
Improved to the point that his management tells me that he could stand with some of the best boxers around. He relishes the fact of having a boxing fight. I personally don't recommend it, but he relishes the fact about it. And
where is he learning this? I mean, he's got Black House. I mean, we see what they're able to do, but who's teaching him this stuff?
We all know it's Steven Seagal. You know that.
That was a trick question. Obviously, it's Steven Seagal. Thank you, Steven.
Can I tell you something about Steven?
Yeah.
I went to do a commercial with Anderson Silva, Lyoto, Steven, and Dan Migliotta down in Buenos Aires last year, a Budweiser commercial for Brazil. And when I got in there, I had to get off the plane, get in the tux, and get to the set because they were filming around me. I was coming from a UFC. So I go in and I had an hour to kill, and who's training? They go, come on downstairs. They're training. So I go downstairs, right? And they're training in a private room. And who are they training with? Steven. I watched Steven Seagal train them.
Wow.
Now, I've told Joe this. I've told Joe Silva this. And Joe Silva says, well, I can't comment what Joe said, but let's just say that not everybody's really too enamored of the image of Steven Seagal in MMA.
Sure.
But I'm gonna say something that I truly believe, okay? Mm-hmm. I watched him train these guys, and then Steven invited me out to dinner that night. We had a nice one-on-one dinner for 2 hours, which was a fascinating 2 hours.
I bet.
The guy is very intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
He has stories up the yin-yang
yep.
to tell. They all make sense to me. He showed me total respect, paid me total respect. We had a really nice time.
Hmm.
He's a friend. I consider Steven a friend.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we were friends before this on a professional level, but we became like, we kind of bonded that night. So mm-hmm. now I'm not sitting here saying he taught them something, but I'm going to point out a parable. I watched him teaching him the front kick in the training session. I watched him do ridge hands and different strikes and karate strikes to the clavicle and the forehead and wrist locks as the guys put their hands out, which maybe you can't get a guy in a wrist lock.
I've seen video of this.
And I watched him lead Lyoto around to the point of tears.
Mm.
Okay. And I talked to Lyoto and I talked to Anderson. Nothing but the utmost respect for a sensei. That's all I can tell you.
But that makes sense. First of all, those guys, what makes certainly Anderson Silva so good is he takes from everything. He takes from everywhere.
Right.
He's so open to anything. And the idea that Steven Seagal has been training and studying martial arts his whole life and that he wouldn't have anything to teach you, you know, I was talking to Joe about that. He did. You can say what you want. It was the first time we saw a front kick used.
That's my point.
I mean, that's a Taekwondo thing. But, I mean, it was the first time we saw a front kick to the face. And, you know, there's no reason to believe that he didn't. There are other guys. I mean, Boss Rutan's like, we study. We all know how to do front kick. And I get it. But there's no reason to believe that he didn't have something to say or teach.
But here's what he taught them. I know what it is. I even told him at dinner. I said, I know what you taught them. And he goes, tell me what you think I did. And I'm going to tell you what I told him. And he said, you're right. Okay. The front kick in Taekwondo, which I've Taekwondo, but they're Korean arts. But the mm-hmm. basic front kick is a yellow belt kick. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They even learn it right in the white belt area. And you learn how to perfect it. You pick up the knee. We're taught to use the knee as a gun sight, follow through with the kick, snap it out there. Right. He teaches them, not that it's any brain science or rocket science, but he teaches them as they're in the move to kick below the peripheral vision of your opponent. And if you notice when they kick, the leg, the leg that is that they're standing on, the non-kicking leg, the brace leg is bent. It's not, you know, we kick and maybe extend that leg, and extend the body.
Yep.
Keep the knee at a bent position so you come in low, not bringing your knee up like a gun sight.
So you see it, I see.
It's almost like a football kick to the chin. So as you're standing there, right, and then you come up, you don't see it until it's too late.
Yeah.
Well, not just one kick, but 3 months later, we're in Canada. The night that I blew my ACL announcing George St. Pierre in the octagon, I blew my knee. That same night, Lyoto Machida fought Randy Couture. And the same exact kick, the same exact student story of Steven Seagal visiting them and training them, it happened two times only ever in the history of the UFC octagon within 3 months of each other from two guys that train under Steven Seagal. Now, come on.
You got to give
it up. Let's give it up.
At least a little bit. At least a little.
A little.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not going to. I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't know Steven Seagal.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's capable of. I wrestled and fought long enough to know how much I don't know.
Yeah.
And I certainly learned a long, long time ago never to judge anybody, a book by its cover. And if somebody spent their whole life fighting, I don't want any piece of them. That's their arena. I'm a comic. I'm not, you know.
I hear you.
You know, Steven Seagal could probably do some damage to you. He's a nasty dude,
but he's also huge, Brian.
He's also a big guy.
He's a big guy. He's 6'6", and he weighs like 290. Let's give him the benefit of the under 300.
That's a big man.
I think it might go over. But
okay, so he's gained some weight, but he's also a big, big, big bones.
His hands are the size of my face when he puts a fist. I don't want to get hit by him.
That's a whole different, yeah.
I don't want to go there.
He's a giant man.
He's a giant man.
So
a giant.
I'm not about to sit there and go, yay. No, but
he's trained. You've got to respect the arts. I mean, to disrespect, honestly, in my opinion, as a martial artist mentality, to disrespect another art, sensei, black belt trained, you can say all you want about his CIA talk. You can say all I want, whatever. But I'm going to respect him like I'm going to represent a Taekwondo black belt teaching traditional dojo point fighting to students. Okay,
yeah.
It's their art. They work for it. They deserve the respect.
Well, I also come down to the fact that, you know, I was talking to Shab about this, Brendan Shab about this. Look, man, But whenever you walk around and you don't respect somebody for being whatever, like I'm tougher than he is or whatever, none of us are tough. A knife can do the job very quickly. A gun can do the job very quickly. So we're flesh and blood. So there is no he's tougher than I am. No. It all depends on context. It all depends on what kind of technology you have in your hand. It all depends on whether you're looking or not. Thousand things.
All depends on who hits first.
UFC's taught us anything, it's the tough guys from yesterday wouldn't stand a chance with the tough guys today because the game has evolved. So best to stay humble and best to, and I think most people who know the fight game and respect the fight game and like the fight game understand that. It's one of the reasons I love going to these UFC events because people are so cool. I mean, fighters especially. It's just like,
well, that's,
you know,
that's one of the reasons where organically it's grown to the level it has, because all the fighters, including the other people, I think, too, that are part of the UFC, like Joe Rogan and Goldie, and I like to think of myself as the same way. Everybody's approachable.
Yeah.
Right? And that's created a whole comfort zone with fans.
Well, Dana White's done a really good job of creating, I think he's modeled UFC after the NFL in the sense that there's it's a very, very strict organization.
Mm-hmm.
From a business point of view, they've done a really good job of making the UFC the superstar, not any one fighter.
That mistake was made by them a little bit in the beginning when Tito was getting all the press and you're putting it all around Tito and an individual fighter. And I agree that the brand is everything.
Right.
The brand is everything. It's all about the brand. You've got to keep the brand strong because fighters, with all respect to all these great fighters who I know and love, they come and they go. Because it's possible everybody's going to get beaten.
Dude,
there will be
so
no
hard.
Unbeaten
you get
records.
Injured, whatever it is.
It's a tough game. It's the loneliest game in town.
Shane Carwin, who I got to know just very briefly, and I was so impressed with the guy. I mean, he's got his engineering degree, and he's just a house. He's a giant man. And I guess he hurt his knee, and
it's been a hard time for him.
Yeah.
And getting back to one thing, when you mentioned Dana, every time I see Dana and Lorenzo and Frank Fertitta, I mentally bow to these guys.
Yeah.
Because if it wasn't for their brilliant move taking over a fledgling organization and doing all the work they did, and you can say whatever you want, and I hate these things about fighters' salaries. They're making so many millionaires left and right, or guys making steady six-figure incomes.
They also have a lot of fighters on their roster. They're responsible,
over 400.
Too. Yeah, so when you're running a business, it's a very difficult thing. Again, another example of just what when you created the UFC, let's begin with, when you created it and made it what it is, which gave a lot of people a job, it's there's always going to be things you can criticize about it, but it's a very difficult job. I don't know what it's like to run that business, so I'm not going to criticize anybody.
It's very difficult.
It's a tough one. You know?
It's very difficult, but their maverick business acumen mixed with the financials they were able to put in, because they went in the hole like $44 million before they started making any money, and Ultimate Fighter pulled them out. Big risk.
Yeah.
You know, just huge credit. Honestly, without them, we wouldn't be having this interview right now. I think the whole sport would be underground.
Yeah.
And Dana's made it so approachable, with himself being approachable too. I mean, what fight promoters hold Q&As before weigh-ins?
I love Dana, though, because
who does that?
I don't know him. I've met him a couple times through Joe very briefly, but I love him because he's so emotional. He's so in love with fighting and so in love with fighters, and he freaks out on them. Like, he's like, he'll never fight for the UFC again. I can tell you that. He's done. Yeah. And then I'm thinking of Nate, for example, and then he can't help himself. He lets him back in because he's got a huge, at the end of the day, I don't care what anybody says, the guy's got a big heart because he just can't stick to his guns. He can't ban anybody forever. He gets it. It's like, you got a second chance. You fucked up. I'm mad at you right now. Fuck it. You're back in. I love that about him. That's something that I think is to his strength, not at all to his weakness.
Well, the good thing is it's purity. He's giving you pure emotion, and he wears it on his sleeve. He doesn't make any doubts about it.
He fucking wears it on his sleeve. He's so wonderfully unprofessional. He is. I love him for that,
All I'll say on that note is it's wonderful because the loyalty they've shown me as I've shown them, and the team they've put together that I get to ride this UFC locomotive uphill with no end in sight. It's an amazing experience.
You see yourself doing this for as long as the UFC's around, huh?
Well, I think it's more so to say, because UFC is going to certainly outlive me. I think it's more to say, as long as I'm physically and mentally capable of doing what I do, I'm going to be there. Yeah.
And you'll be a piece of this history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
17 years now. I've only missed two shows.
17 years.
17
dude.
Years.
17 years.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you coming and doing the show, brother. It's always
great.
It's good to finally get together and have a real conversation.
I forgot one answer to them.
Yeah.
The fights that I've seen.
Yeah.
I think back to the wars with Randy Couture and Pedro Hizo. You know, yeah, I think back to brawls like that that I got a chance to see. Mark Coleman, king of the headbutts, dropping his head down into opponents with devastating fashion.
God, back when you were allowed to do all that
stuff. Yeah, when you were allowed to do all that. And those were fights because they were fights before the refinement and the spectacle became a sport. And it's like I got to see all that. And I got to see the highlight of the pay-per-view days to the low end when I'm in I think Lake Charles, Louisiana, and it's like UFC 23 or 4, I think, and suddenly the main event's coming on, and we've got this, I want to say another word, we got this Louisiana crowd out there, you know, of 1,800 people. That's where we went. My first one was 9,000.
I was there, dude.
You were there?
I was there, yeah.
And I had announced to the crowd that there was no main event because Randleman slipped on a banana peel pole in the back on a pole and knocked himself out, and he's on the way to the hospital with a concussion.
I remember that. That
was the lowest
weird
point.
Oh, dude,
you were there
that
then at
there
the lowest point.
I was there. Yeah. I was there with Joe. That's
and
right.
I'm like, ending that, I'm like, where are we going to go? Where's
we were
this
in a,
going?
We were fight. It was a parking lot. Remember? It was like you had to walk through a parking lot, and there was like a big tent or something. Yeah. Fights were breaking out. It was just redneck central. Sorry. I've
done fights in cowboy bars where, honestly, I'm in the ring doing a fight, and there were more fights out there in the tables.
Crazy, man. It was crazy. That was. I remember that very well. That was. What year was that?
I'm going to say that 96? That's going to go back to, no, actually it's right before the Fertittas took over. This is more like about 99.
Okay.
Right around there. I'd have to look it up to check, but give or take a year. But
yeah.
Look, it's like you and your comedy act. I mean, I remember when I was going to the Comedy Store, if you don't mind taking a couple more minutes.
No.
Because I also am a huge fan of your choice of endeavor, where you're passionate and Joe's passionate about, which is stand-up comedy. Yeah. I just think is the ballsiest thing in the world to do. And I'm actually a frustrated guy from my younger years where I actually wanted to stand up and do stand-up comedy.
Oh, did you? Oh, that's great.
I sit there like watching fighters and watching my favorite movie stars. I sit in the audience watching Jim Carrey when he was 18 at Mitzi Gaynor's Comedy Store up on Sunset, and knowing that he's sleeping on her couch. You know, this is when he's starting out, or Andrew Dice Clay when they're starting out, and Robin Williams steps in to do a warm-up set.
That's right.
Down in Westwood, and David Letterman's hosting the Monday through Friday comedy
I was just at the comedy store, and Ronda Rousey was there. I was so excited, I couldn't take it.
I thought you were at the Laugh Factory. You were at the comedy
store? I do both. But the other day, I was at the comedy store.
She must.
Ronda Rousey was there, and I was trying a bunch of new stuff. I was like, no! I was actually nervous. I never get nervous. I was nervous that she was in the audience. I just wanted to impress her, but, you know, hopefully.
I can see why you want to impress Ronda. She's, you know, let's just to dabble on that. There's so many things I could talk to you about, Brian. But, you know, I want to talk to Ronda for a second. Yeah. Getting back to your career. It's like, think about the dirty, dingy comedy places you have worked and been on the road in, and the crappy audiences.
For 12 alcoholics at 2 in the morning.
Yeah, think about all that you went through. It's kind of like my gestation period with the UFC. You've gotten to see it all, Brian.
Dude, Dave Attell one time, it was at the Comedy Cellar. It was Tuesday. It was 1 in the morning or something, and Dave Attell, this is before he got really famous, and Dave Attell gets up and goes, "You're probably wondering what I'm doing here at 1 o'clock on a Tuesday night for 12 people. Well, I'm not really a comic. I just lost my daughter. Nadine! Nadine! Damn, another dead end. Another dead end." He fucking killed me. It was so classic. Like six people like hating you, fucking stirring their drinks. Like, make us laugh. You know? I did a show in Florida one time in a restaurant. And this old guy, I just started doing my act, and this old guy goes, "Shut up!" And I was like,
what do you say to an old guy?
I was like, exactly. That's what I said. I go, what do I say to an old guy who hates me? Yeah, you shut up. He was crazy. And, you know, you kind of have to go through, you know, that great saying, that sort of, I'm paraphrasing the Buddhist saying of, it takes shit to make a flower.
Right.
You got to go through that, you know?
Yeah, of course. And that's what the UFC went through. Yep. And now, but here's another key to business is, it's one thing to ramp up and get to the top of your career. I think having owned and run so many different businesses, what I always tell everybody, because I teach branding and marketing and seminars, another thing I do, I give motivational seminars. But I tell them, you know, once you get there, this is where you got to be smart. You got to take everything you learned up to this point, and you got to maintain that position, because everybody loves you on the way up. But then they can't wait to see you
How
fail.
Do you maintain that position? I mean, a lot of young people are looking for guidance, and, you know, you've been a successful guy. You're a very disciplined guy. I've known you a long time. You're physically disciplined, and you're disciplined in general, positive. But how would you say is the best way to maintain intensity and success? Because that's something that a lot of people are good at reaching, and they get there and they fall off. But you've been able to kind of, you know, keep this thing going in a lot of different areas.
Right.
What is your advice to young people?
My biggest advice that I can give is that when you're choosing a path in life, because I don't believe that any of us are better than anybody else. I think it's all about the paths we choose. If you choose a path and you want to be the best CEO, the best actor, the best comedian, or the best busboy at your local restaurant, just take pride in what you do to be the best at what you can do. But When you're making a decision about an endeavor choice in life, okay, I don't like working. I like living. Mm. I like living by life by design. So my work life is a design of life. This is my lifestyle. I don't wake up in the morning to go to work.
Right.
I wake up in the morning to passionately live my life
I
with
feel the
choices
way.
I've made.
Yeah.
You have to.
Yeah.
There's no way you can keep up your fervor.
I can't do this.
Well, this is key in the question you're asking. Is that anybody making a choice? Ask yourself, look in the mirror, be honest with yourself. Are you in it for the buck? Are you in it for the potential of the buck? Because you're passionate about what you're going to go into, which means you're going to learn everything there is about it. You want to be the best you can be at it. But when the crap hits the fan, when the rough times happen, which is going to happen no matter what, don't think that life's going to be a breeze because you made the right choice. Mm-hmm. You are going to get hit with the big life choices of life mm-hmm. in your choice of endeavor. The only way you can get up from being knocked down on the canvas of business is the best way is to have passion and believe in yourself. That's the key, because a lot of people enter projects just to make money. They're not passionate. And when the hard times hit, they lose that edge.
It also starts, don't you think, with isolating exactly what you want to do, right?
Well, it's called being focused. We live in an ADD society. The problem with society today is we don't open a magazine and see 3-page articles about subjects anymore. We open up Maxim and we see capsulated quarter-page articles.
It's why I love the podcast. You can spend an hour actually getting to know somebody. Yeah.
But people don't talk anymore. They text in the same room to each other. The communication levels of the younger generation, I'm sorry to say, are very poor. Mm-hmm. It might be to the point where 10 years from now, not only we might be lacking good comedic talent because they don't learn those communication skills, we also might be lacking in business the perfect salesman to sell our products because everything is going to be pressing buttons and keys and stuff.
There'll be a backlash. I think there always is. You know, when there's a problem, people go back to tradition. You see it all the time. People will start to... I mean, I when I watch the UFC, I almost can see how boxing evolved. In some ways, like it's almost like we're going to come full circle. Like I watch to, we won't, but when I watched UFC, a lot of guys can neutralize themselves with wrestling. So they don't want to be on the ground and they want to knock each other out. And now they're both sitting there, maybe throwing a couple kicks, but for the most part, throwing their hands.
Right.
It's just an interesting, it's an interesting thing. You can almost see how fighting probably started as back in the day as boxing, I would imagine, evolved out of just two fisticuff guys getting out there and beating each other up.
If you go back to the days of bare knuckle boxing that they used to have, like when John Sullivan used to fight, or some of these guys, when they were standing across from each other like this. And John Sullivan once had a fight that went something like 82 rounds.
God.
My grandfather fought the same kind of fighting. He had fights that were like 30, 40 rounds, right? Yeah. You got to remember, they weren't beating the hell out of each other. They were circling each other. Yeah. Watch a film with Errol Flynn called Gentleman Jim.
Yeah.
Give you a real understanding. Great. Yep. Yeah. Great. Yep. Gentleman Jim Corbett, the man that invented the jab in boxing, moving around the ring. And he totally distilled the theories of the manly art of boxing pugilism and took it to another level. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what the UFC has done to the fighting arts, because it wasn't just blood sport like it was in the beginning. Who's got the best style?
Right.
What's your style?
Right.
You know,
right.
The art of fighting without fighting, you know?
Right.
So it's like, the bottom line is that then it grew into where Jeff Blatnick, God bless his soul, passed recently.
I didn't know Jeff died.
Oh, Jeff died less than a year ago.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I saw him at a show and he died 2 weeks later.
How old was he?
He was young. Jeff was my age, 55 years old.
How did he die? A heart attack?
I just want to say natural causes. I don't think it was more of his cancer issue. I think
he
got
that
beat. He
had a cancer issue?
Well, if you remember, he won the Olympic gold medal. After
he had lymphoma, right?
And he got out of it.
That's
and won the Olympic gold medal.
He had Hodgkin's disease, I think, or something like
that. I'd have to look it up. But he's one of the most amazing sports stories there is. A man deserved to be respected.
Man, I love that guy. I remember him. I knew him.
He passed away.
What a wrestling great, incredible.
So even John McCarthy will tell you, I think it was, that he is the one that really coined it, mixed martial arts. Mm. So it became mixed martial arts. I actually stopped watching the UFC after UFC 3. I was really turned off by just how brutal it was getting, a little bit, because I'd seen so many street fights. It's like, you know what? I'll go to the back of the bar.
Well, you see somebody's teeth splatter,
It was a little rough. I was watching with my friends and stuff. But then I thought, you know what? This is fighting. Don't do that. And then I went back into it, and then I signed Michael to do the event and had to pull him out because the WCW was upset. He said if it's not in the octagon, it's not real, because back then they wanted everybody to think it was real.
Right.
You know, wrestling, that is.
Right.
Sports entertainment, with all respect to the wrestlers doing their work, which I have respect for. But then it became mixed martial arts, and now these guys coming along, there's 12-year-olds in the dojo doing stuff now that people tell you that are going to blow us away when they're 18, 20.
No question, man.
These guys are going to fly in that octagon with a friggin' cape.
Yep.
They're like supermen.
Yep.
Totally. Yep. Charles Barkley took me 3 years. 3 years of seeing him every Super Bowl weekend at Mandalay Bay to get to go to a UFC. Finally went, right? Next day in the gym, he says, Buff, he says, these are the most highly conditioned athletes in the world.
I saw him at a couple of UFCs. I saw him when he's, yeah. That,
he's
I
blown
that.
Away.
Yeah.
Blown away.
You can't not respect it because it's competition on its rawest, in its rawest form.
But you know how surfing went extreme? Skateboarding went extreme. Yeah. Skiing went extreme. Snowmobiles went extreme. The poor guy died recently in trying to loop his snowmobile. The younger generation, which is the current, which is, you know, I'm 55, but even another generation down, and now the generation of the 18 to 34s now, they crave on the quick hit, the excitement. A 15-round fight in boxing for 3-minute rounds, or 12-round, excuse me. You know when that changed? Do you know when 15 rounds became 12 rounds?
Because somebody died?
Boom Boom Mancini.
That's right.
When he killed the Korean in the ring.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Kim, whose name was Kim?
Yes. Moo Goo Kim or something. His father was his coach, I remember. Yeah,
exactly. They went to 12 rounds after that.
I didn't know that was the
case. That was the precursor to the 15 to 12 rounds.
Yeah, I think Jay Moore told me that. I'm not sure.
So, you know, and there's levels that have changed in boxing, you know? Yeah. But now John Jones throwing spinning elbows and who else we have coming up. It's unbelievable.
It's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
You're getting NFL-level athletes in the UFC. I mean, you know, you already have them.
I did have one NFL guy say to me, well, you know, training for the NFL is harder than training for to be a mixed martial artist. I said, are you kidding me?
Well, Brendan Schaub would disagree with that, and he played in the NFL. I mean,
because NFL's explosive.
Yeah.
You have 3 hours
of It's also one skill set. It's also I catch balls, or I, you know, being a pro football player is amazing and very
hard. It's incredible.
But you're not having to wrestle, box, you do a kick. There's a lot of stuff. You're working on multi-levels when it comes to being.
Multi-levels that it takes even the boxing world to. You're right. I want to say one thing about the football. I respect football. It's hard as hell to play NFL football. But in 3 hours, you have something like 12 minutes of action.
That's right.
But it's brutal. Yeah. And more guys get hurt in one Sunday in the NFL than a whole year in the UFC.
Your injury rate, they say, in the NFL is 100%.
Nice. If you're a lineman, I mean, Dick Buckus, he's living in my neighborhood. He couldn't even walk down the street properly.
I worked with him, yeah.
So you know.
Another giant, yeah.
But Bernard Hopkins, the great fighter, the boxing fighter we talked to, never been out of shape a day in his life, total practitioner, master practitioner of the art of boxing. He was at a UFC, and I walked up because I know Bernard for years. I'm working with Michael. I've managed Michael's career for 20 years. Hmm. So I've been in the world. I've done business with Don King, everybody you can name about. I know boxing like the back of my hand. But here's Bernard. So I took it upon myself to walk up. Bernard, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah. Hey, Bruce, blah, blah, blah. I said, Bernard, I got to ask you. You've called our guys, even used the term homosexuals one time, okay?
Yeah, he's disrespectful.
You did. We're disrespectful, but you're sitting here now. I just have to ask you, Bernard, do you understand it? Do you get it? He said, in so many words, you know, because just we're friends, so yeah. Professional level friends. So he said, Bruce, the moment I train with them, when I train with them and realize the fine condition, skilled athletes they are, you can't help but respect what mixed martial arts is all about.
There it is.
Bing, bang, gold ring. Thank you. Where's Jim Lampley? Right? You know?
I mean, you can't, being witness to it, you can't not respect it.
You can't. You know, you're kidding yourself. Now we have another parable. I'm sorry, I get a little worried.
It's great.
Mayweather. Known him for years. Always nice to me. Good kid. I hate the bling bling crap. I can't stand it. I want to throw up every time I see it. I'll be honest with you, okay? If that's his world, that's fine. Great fighter. Great boxer, mm-hmm. without question. But he's at the Mandalay Bay. We just finished a show. So I'm going in the high roller pit. You want to get a little drink or whatever. There he is with his bodyguards, his, you know, Muhu bodyguards and all that. So he walks up to me. Hey, Bruce, how are you? Oh, shaking my hand, gives me a hug. Congratulations on all your success. It's been awesome. Da, 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 da. Really happy to see you and everything going on. I said, thanks. Thanks, Floyd. I really appreciate that. You know, I'm a huge fan of yours. Always have been. And I said, what did you think of the show? Because we just did the show. I thought it was at the UFC.
Yeah.
He said, no, I didn't go. I said, why? He said, I'll never be seen at a UFC. I said, Floyd, why? You know what? I think I get it, Floyd. I won't even ask you. I understand. And I let it go.
Yeah.
But now I'm asking you, Brian, why? If you're an, if you, you need to open your mind and appreciate everything.
I think part of that might be the theatrics. I think he's a theatrical guy.
Absolutely.
I also think part of it is that it's not very relevant to him. I think he probably is one of those guys who doesn't give a shit about fighting in some ways. I mean, when you're a fighter, and a lot of guys who do it as a living can't stand to watch it. It doesn't have any relevance to him
yeah.
as a boxer. He's proved to himself how great a fighter he is, probably in his mind, and he's probably right. If he had been in mixed martial arts, he would have been just as good. You know, I would imagine that's probably, it's somewhere in that area.
Yeah.
I think it's not as much a mystery. Well, we watch things a lot of times because there's mystery in it. We watch the UFC sometimes as a man because there's some mystery to what is it like to be naked in an octagon in front of millions of people fighting for your life.
Mm-hmm.
That's, unless you've really experienced that. We've all been athletes and stuff like that. There's still a lot of mystery there. There's a lot of wonder. There's a lot of like awe in the fact that these guys are able to do it. And I think Floyd has had such an intimate relationship with fighting and all that it encompasses that it probably hasn't got the same mystery or luster.
Well,
I think watching the way they box hurts his eyes because he's
such it'll hurt any boxer's eyes. Yeah. Yeah, no
question. Then the rest is okay. You know, they're really good wrestlers. He doesn't really know wrestling. So he doesn't know what to look for with it.
I'm going to go with you on all that, but I'm going to add one more to it.
Mm-hmm.
Same reason that I think Jim Lampley suffers from and Bob Arum suffers
yeah.
from. And it's the art of denial because you feel threatened.
Of course.
Yeah.
That's for sure in there. And that's very common for men.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it over and over. When you see two guys who have the courage to get in there, you feel a little shame. Mm-hmm. It shames you a little bit, you know?
Because you have the one art, but here you are, the great boxer and fighter, and you think to yourself, probably it's going through his mind, well, I could get in there, but then again, I can't get in there.
No man wants to be confronted with his own mortality.
Exactly.
And when you watch the UFC and you watch these guys, you are confronted with how vulnerable. I love the game. Personally, I don't like going to fight sometimes because I'm around a bunch of killers, including people in the audience, and I feel like a pussy.
You hang out with Joe Rogan. You're around a killer 24 hours a day.
Of course. I love them all. But I mean, I still, as much as I love being around fighters and have friends who are fighters, we always have a great time. I also feel men don't like to feel like the weakest guy in the room.
But aren't they a bunch of the nicest guys you've ever met?
Of course. They're great.
They're sweethearts.
Because they have felt like they're the weakest guy in the room a lot of times.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Because they've been knocked out, you know?
So let me give you another question. Mm. I went Friday night to see Mike Tyson's one-man play, which was fantastic.
Dude, I was just talking. My boy Jeremy Piven was just telling me he went and loved it.
It was fantastic.
It.
And, and I'm sure I could see Jeremy, who's a huge boxing fan, getting off on it. And they showed the video of Mike, as ferocious as he was, with his side-to-side movement and his hands and his short move, what I was trying to get across earlier, the short distance of punches that he would throw to create the most devastating results possible. And it's like, how do you stop this guy in a boxing ring? I couldn't even imagine trying to stop this guy, much less even standing in front of him. Now, Mike Tyson, at Mike Tyson's heyday, stepping into an octagon, I still believe that unless he could catch you in that first minute with one of those shots, like Matt Serra and George St. Pierre, right?
Mm-hmm.
That Tito Ortiz, even in 2 minutes, could subdue him and take him down and tap him out.
I would say to you that you're talking about, inarguably, maybe with the exception of Ernie Shavers,
the only guy that have a shot.
No, I would say to you that nobody hits harder. You're talking about the hardest.
Oh, the hardest hitting guy. Yeah. Right.
In hardest hitter in boxing, arguably. Roy Jones Jr. said to me one time that he thinks Joe Frazier hit harder. I don't know. I'm not going to argue with him. But I would say arguably a lot of people would suggest that Mike Tyson is, if not the hardest hitter in boxing, one of the hardest top two, top three. That's saying a lot.
It's a lot.
That's why even when you were wearing gloves, you couldn't make a mistake and you were 230-pound, you know, Razor Ruddock or one of these guys he fought, and he would just send you across the ring.
Yeah.
So when you put no gloves on that guy, you can't make any mistakes.
No.
I also think he's probably inhumanly strong, but your point is well taken in the sense that when it comes to wrestling And when it comes to that whole other dimension,
right.
Maybe it favors somebody with longer arms. Maybe it favors somebody with longer legs. I don't know. I have to believe that Mike Tyson was such a ferocious fighter and put on the earth to do one thing, which is fight.
Mm-hmm.
And if Mike had to learn those other disciplines or had come up learning those, he would have.
I believe it.
And I think he would have been at the top of the food chain.
I believe it. I think yeah. He made a comment too that it's something he would have wanted done when he was younger.
It was also his mentality, by the way.
Yeah.
He also had a very he's a fierce guy.
After we're done this podcast, I'm going to tell you a funny quickie about Mike Tyson.
Oh,
I really cannot tell on this podcast.
I can't tell it on the cast. I love it. That's one of the fun things about being in sort of Los Angeles with lots of friends who are, you know, they're kind of mixing with like different celebrities. You people have these secret stories that they can never really share.
There's a few, even in the book.
Well,
you know,
I want to hear it. We've already gone over. We're about an hour and five.
Oh,
you've been
great.
Oh,
I'm sorry. No,
I love it. Listen. You've been. I knew you'd be a great guest. So
that means I get to come back, or you get to come on my show.
No question.
Okay.
No question, man. And I want to thank you for. Bruce Buffer still in the splits, ladies and gentlemen. Still in the splits.
Now I'm
it's
on the floor.
It's a minute and almost four. I'm sorry, an hour and almost 4 minutes, and the man is still holding it. Now he's on the floor. He finally gave himself a break. We'll talk to you guys later, Brian Callen.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Best.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.